Position number 21581, wheel 1.
Is it now?
Ronald Apps, Reel 1, where were you born, please?
I was born in East London, in East Ham.
Which year was this?
This was in 1919.
Did your parents both come from London?
Yes, both my parents came from London. Basically from Poplar.
What did your father do for a living?
I would hate to give you a long and very involved story of my father, but he originally worked for a man called Samuels, bringing tortoiseshell over from the East Indies for use in spectacle frames, and the name of the company was called the Shell Transport and Trading Company. And Mr. Samuels decided to go into this newfangled stuff called petrol. And my father used to sell 2 gallon cans of petrol off the back of a horse-drawn wagon. He originally sold it in the South End area and then became finally London sales manager for this company. And in 1908 he decided there was no future in this stuff called petrol, and he left the Shell Transport and Trading Company and joined a very small company dealing in lubricating oils, because he felt there would always be a need for lubricating oils.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in eastern part of London?
No. In actual fact, my parents were not exactly aged, but both my parents were 40 when I was born, because my mother had had various children before that had either died a stillbirth or she had aborted them. And we left East Ham when I was 4 years of age, and we moved to Ilford, which in actual fact, although it is Essex, is now totally absorbed by Greater London. So my schooling was in Ilford in Essex.
How old were you when you finished schooling?
I was 15 and a half when I finished schooling, but that was basic schooling, and then after that I joined the P&O group and served my apprenticeship as a marine engineer to go to sea as an engineer officer with the P&O, and of course continued then schooling at the School of Engineering and Navigation, which went with my apprenticeship. That was for 4.5 years, 4¾ years, before the Navy caught up with me and I had to go into the Navy in November 1939.
Did you do much voyaging pre-war?
Only with the Royal Naval Volunteer Reserve, which I had joined as an ordinary seaman in 1937. And there we did trips out on whalers, sailing, training and what have you, and also trips down to Portsmouth to see various warships and get the feel of the thing.
Why did you want to join RNVR pre-war?
Basically because I have the sea in my blood. My grandfather was the steward on the Cuttish Sark at one time, and it's a long and very involved story, but he was with what was the predecessor of the P&O group, and I just feel that I've always had the sea in my blood. And even at school, when I looked out at houses and saw four chimneys, I would think to myself, they are four funnels on a ship sailing at sea. It's one of those interesting things that you feel. I put my name down for serving an apprenticeship with the P&O, believe it or not, when I was, 13 years of age.
Why P&O?
This was the company that my grandfather had worked with and was buried in India in 1892 in Vizagapatam.
Where did you operate out of with RNVR in London?
Oh, this was the HMS President on the embankment in London, on the Thames.
And what kind of training did you have with them pre-war?
Basically as a seaman, an ordinary seaman. And then after 12 months, I qualified as an able seaman. But in early 1939, I left the Royal Naval Volunteer Reserve because I found my studies were getting so, the amount of studying I was having to do and the amount of homework I was having to do interfered with my attendance at training sessions for the Royal Naval Volunteer Reserve.
Had you at that time thought that a war was about to break out?
I didn't think a war would break out because in 1938, in September 1938, when there was a bit of a scare that war was coming, I felt that myself, for some reason, that it would not actually become a war. It is possible that the influence of the Americans as such would ensure that the war would not, in actual fact, take place.
So how did you feel when Neville Chamberlain declared war on Germany?
I imagine that at the age I was then at 20, very despondent, but not enthusiastic at all about going to war. And I don't think, in actual fact, there were many people in this country at that time who really were terribly anti-German, possibly anti the Nazis as such, the Nazi party, but not the total German population.
Did the war affect you immediately?
Well, yes, because any time from then on I was going to be called up, because in July 1939, I had to register for conscription, because all young men of the age of 20 had to register and go through a medical examination to ensure that they were available for conscription, because by that time this had been introduced by the government, and so I knew that once war was declared, I was going to be called up.
And then?
Well, then I had a notice in, I think it was about the end of September 1939, that I would be called up into the Royal Navy, because that was the service that I had expressed a preference. And I was finally called early in November 1939, and I went down to Chatham joined the Royal Navy. I indicated that I had been training as a marine engineer, and I was therefore, it was suggested to me that I took a trade test, which I did, and was therefore qualified as an engine room artificer.
What was the next step?
Well, the next step was that they found that I had spent the previous 9 months or so in the head office of the P&O company, where I was doing what was basically a fifth year national certificate, doing industrial administration, and I had also been in the drawing office, and so they put me over into the mechanical training establishment in the drawing office there in order to inspire young men who were stokers training to be mechanicians to learn something about draftsmanship and being able to sketch pieces of machinery.
What did that involve as far as you were concerned?
Showing young men how to produce elevations on a piece of machinery on a drawing board. In other words, a plan, a side elevation, a cross-section, what have you, of a piece of machinery. I had been taught at school, at engineering college.
Where were you doing this?
This was at Chatham, on the mechanical training establishment in Chatham Dockyard.
And we're talking about 39-40?
We're talking about January 1940. And I stayed there for January, February, March 1940. And then in April I left there and went down to Sheerness and joined HMS Grenade.
What kind of ship was this?
This HMS Grenade is a G-class destroyer.
What impression did it make on you at first?
Impression was, we're going to war. Because HMS Grenade was in Sheerness Dockyard having a boiler clean and various odds and ends of repairs carried out. And then after that, she would have sailed for convoy work. But I left her just before she sailed.
So how long were you with the ship?
I was with the ship for about 6 weeks, I suppose.
Doing any work in the ship?
Oh, yes, just doing general running repairs that had been scheduled by the ERAs who were running the ship. And they had gone off on leave. And I was refitting valves, packing glands, doing the odds and ends that anybody does while a ship is in harbour, the mechanical repairs which were considered necessary.
What was your impression of the state of the machinery in this ship? Was your first R&D?
In excellent condition, because this was only 6 months into the war, and the Grenade at that time would only have been about 2 years old. And she was therefore in a very good condition, all things considered.
So there was not much to do?
Well, there's always little bits to do, because in the running of a ship you're always going to have glands that will leak, glands that are round the spindles on the valves that are where you, the valve spindle runs up and down through a gland to ensure that the steam inside the pipe on which the valve is located does not leak out into the engine room. And glands don't last forever, because while you're opening and shutting valves, you're always depreciating the glands.
So a gland is a seal?
A gland is a seal, yes. And so while the boiler is shut down, the engines are shut down, you have the opportunity of going round, lifting out the gland seals, fitting new gland material, and then sealing it all up again. Purely on routine.
What happened to you next?
After that, I stayed at the base at Sheerness and acted really as what would only laughingly be referred to as spare crew. I went on various ships at various times. I was on HMS Campbell for a while, which was a flotilla leader for the V&W class destroyers. I was on her for about 3 or 4 weeks. But we only went out from Sheerness Harbour onto what was known as the boom area of the Thames estuary to make sure that submarines didn't come up the Thames. Also to rescue any ditched pilots, fighter pilots from the Royal Air Force that had to ditch into the sea. It was really just a filling in and training while you were doing it, because you were getting used to the, certainly I was, the type of watchkeeping and service life of the Navy as opposed to the merchant service for which I had been trained. The engines obviously were very much more powerful than I had been used to in the merchant service. Sometimes five or six times more powerful. The average horsepower on a merchant ship at that time was about 10,000 horsepower, and I, on a destroyer, it was anything between 30 and 40,000 horsepower.
Did you actually go out to try to rescue RAF pilots?
Oh, we did actually rescue one RAF pilot in his dinghy. I remember that. Then in July, I think it was, July 1940, I joined a tanker which was anchored off Sheerness, one of three, for an idea which I have always assumed was thought up by Churchill, and the idea was that these tankers were filled up with fuel oil, and light fuel oil, anyhow. And they were mines and detonators in down in the holds. And the idea was that we were going to run them over to Boulogne, and about 5 miles, 5-6 miles out of the harbour, set the controls and lash them, boilers going full bore, run them into Boulogne Harbour and let them blow up for the to destroy the potential German invasion fleet. That was a thing called Operation Lucid, for which I just recently written an article, which has been published in Southwest Soundings. We spent our time practicing, setting the controls, and evacuating the ship. We had alongside us two speedboats which had been commandeered, I think, from Southend-on-Sea, which was across the river from us at Sheerness. And these speedboats were remarkable things during sort of 35-40 knot efforts. And the idea was that we, at the blowing of a whistle, we had to rush down, get in these boats, and we were going to be away. But finally, it was decided that it was too dicey, too risky, and that we might not get away. We would be blown up as well. And so the whole thing was cancelled. And I always remember that Lieutenant Phipps, who was the commanding officer of the War African on which I was serving, had said, if there's any small memento of the ship that you feel you'd like to take with you, by all means, take it as a souvenir of an adventure that didn't quite come off. And I, in point of fact, stole the ship's bell. And the ship's bell at the moment is out in my hall, acting as a doorstop in the hot weather for the front door to be held open.
Which ship?
This is the War African. This was a Royal Fleet auxiliary tanker. But that was quite in itself a hairy experience. After that, I went back to Sheerness Base.
Before you go back to Sheerness Base,
yes,
were you doing this preparatory work very long?
We were. I suppose the whole operation lasted about 3.5-4 weeks. Basically, because the tanker was full up with fuel oil when it came to us, and it was already primed and ready for exploding. But living aboard was a little bit hairy. We had air raids at night, and when you are sitting in a tanker full of fuel oil and the Germans are coming over dropping bombs, it's not a very, shall I say, sleep-inspiring experience. It's one of those things that you either get used to and say to yourself, well, if I'm going to die, I'm going to die, or you don't sleep. And in the end, I got round to the idea that I just got to sleep, otherwise we wouldn't have been able to walk around the next day. Mind you, the ship had the bare minimum of stuff on it. There was we'd taken our own blankets because it had been stripped completely by the crew when they left. There was nothing aboard. It was a very basic experience, very basic living.
Did you feel anxious about the prospect of carrying out this operation?
Yes, but when one is only 21 years of age, I think fear doesn't come into it. It was one of those things that you... I don't think we were afraid at any time. Worried, perhaps, but not terribly fearful, you know. It was enthusiasm. We were all young people, all very young, none of us over 30. I said the oldest one was 30 years of age. We were all in our early 20s.
And you were doing day-to-day work personally in preparation for the operation?
Oh, yes, I was going to be there, you know, helping drive the ship, as you call it.
So you were looking after engines again?
Oh, yes. I was only a trainee, of course, but I would have been there as a backup for the watchkeepers.
But would you have had an action station?
Oh, yes, the action station I would have been at would be down in the engine room where the engine drivers would have been. Yes.
Any details you can give about the air raids that you experienced?
Well, most of the air raids were at night. On one occasion, I remember there was a bomb dropped in the estuary of the, which was the Medway estuary at Sheerness, but it was at least a mile from us, I should think. But it was the sort of thing that reminded us that we were a vulnerable target, and sitting on so much very explosive material was not exactly a frightening experience, because I can remember distinctly the fact that we weren't frightened, we were just, I could only use the word, apprehensive.
And you were in the War African?
Yes, this was the War African. There were two other ships, I can't remember the names of the other ships, but the War African was the one that I was on.
You were just about to tell me what happened after...
Oh, well, after that, I left the Sheerness base and went back to Chatham. And from Chatham, I was then remustered, you know, allocated another ship. I stayed in Chatham until, I think it was about first week in December. And I was sent then to Greenock in Scotland, where I was standing by the new building, or finishing building, and the commissioning of a depot ship called the Tyne, which was due to go to Scapa Flow, we found, as the depot ship for the Home Fleet destroyers. And so I joined her as an acting fourth class ERA, ready to do my watchkeeping training. And I started doing that while we were doing the trials. We finally commissioned at the end of November 1941, and we sailed from Greenock to do our various trials out on the Outer Clyde estuary for the acceptance trials as from the shipbuilders, which was Scots of Greenock.
What exactly does a depot ship do?
Well, a depot ship carries all the machinery for repairing and supplying, in our case, at least three flotillas of destroyers. We carried machine shop, we had machine shops, we had a cast iron foundry, we had a pattern making shop, we had everything you could think of. An extremely large bakery that supplied fresh bread to the destroyers. We had water-making equipment that was distilleries, evaporators, distillers, to take seawater in and distill it into fresh water, and then very large freshwater tanks from which we supplied destroyers. We had a very large hospital. A depot ship was basically a barracks, a floating barracks, and it carried spare crew to supply to destroyers should anybody go sick or have to be taken off to come into the hospital to be hospitalised. So carried an extra crew, in other words.
What would be your day-to-day work as ERA aboard this ship?
My work on this particular ship was looking after the refrigeration gear, because we had a fairly large amount of refrigeration storage for fresh meat and other supplies. And I also looked after the air compressors, which supplied the very high compressed air for the repair and refurbishment of torpedoes. So in other words, we had compressors there that would give us a fair amount of air at up to 600 pounds per square inch that were in torpedoes. Because the torpedoes only stayed on a destroyer for a certain length of time, then they were taken back aboard the depot ship or sent ashore for refurbishment. And we would refurbish them on a depot ship. So my responsibility was to look after and make sure that the compressors were maintained to their fullest efficiency.
How did the working up of this ship, the Tyne, go? Did it go successfully?
Oh, yes, yes. Yes, most naval ships would have at least 3 or 4 weeks acceptance trials, and it would be very unlikely that anything would go wrong, because there would be Royal Naval personnel at the builders' yards to ensure that everything was done to a first-class standard. And all machinery would have been tested before it actually was put aboard. So in other words, generators would have been tested in the workshops of the people producing the generators and in the presence of Royal Naval personnel to ensure that they did what they were supposed to do.
What are your next memories?
My next memories are going up to Scapa. My next memory was basically, I can remember quite distinctly sailing up to Scapa off the Outer Hebrides, because the Outer Hebrides was not exactly a graveyard, but it's a very, dangerous area, because the German submarines operating in the North Atlantic. And so we were fortunate. We had a destroyer escort, and we also had radar, and we had ASDIC to ensure that we could pick up anything that was dangerous. But I can still remember the wild weather off, funny things that you remember, the wild weather off the Hebrides, and every time after that that I sailed outside the Hebrides, I remember it. And now I have an undying memory of Mendelssohn's Hebridean Overture, and whenever I hear it played, and I have it on both CD and tape, and every now and again I play it to remind myself of the Outer Hebrides.
Was this a happy or unhappy?
Oh, very happy experience. I mean, you can't call it an unhappy experience at all. I mean, it's a memory of people together, comradeship, watchkeeping, talking with people, finding people from different walks of life all together in a big melting pot. Very happy memories, really. Although we were in a dangerous situation, it's still happy memories, I think.
How did the Royal Navy regulars get on with the non-regulars like yourself?
Very well indeed. In fact, most of the ERAs, engine room artificers, that I served with, I would say 75% of them were Royal Navy trained. These were ex-boy artificers in the Royal Navy. But they accepted me into their midst because I had done a similar session of training. In fact, I'd done more. I had done 5 years, and they had mainly, in the main, only done 3. And they accepted me, and most of the old-timers, the old chief ERAs that had been brought back from Naval Reserve when the war was declared, always looked upon me as being an ex-boy, because I had been trained exactly as they had been trained.
What was the attitude of you and your shipmates towards the U-boat crews?
Very difficult to explain. I don't think, even in convoy, when one has seen a ship blown up, was there ever a sense of terror. There was a sense of, let's be more efficient, and let's make sure we know where they are and what we're doing, and let's keep out of their way. I don't think there was any sense of animosity. I don't think it would be a case that if a U-boat crew had been brought before us, there would have been any animosity whatsoever. I think we were all in it together. They were fighting a war. We were fighting a war. And that was it.
Did you feel that they were doing anything illegitimate?
I never saw anything illegitimate. We had submarines out to sink German shipping.